We are a few minutes late of starting, and I want to get going as quickly as possible. The clerk will note the roll, and we have a meeting of the Ways and Means Committee, but also involved in this meeting is our members of the Finance Committee, chaired by Representative Carlson. So, Representative Carlson, any opening remarks?
Well, Mr. Chairman, just to comment, for finance, it's not an official meeting, but finance members were invited to sit in, so I welcome those that were able to attend. And it's my understanding that the finance members will be able to fully participate in the discussion. Is that
we will not dare.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
With that, then we have the agendas before us, and there's the minutes of May 14th, 2009. Representative Mahoney with
I'd like to move in, sir.
And Mahoney has moved. Any discussions, corrections? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed and carried. Okay, Dr. Stenson and Mr. Showalter and Mr. Hansen, you want to come before us? I just greeted Dr. Stenson. I said I always like to see him, but it would sure be nice if he would be a bearer of good news instead of, I don't know if I'm real enthused about meeting him anymore. But welcome to the committee, Dr. Stenson. And I think what we'll try to do is let you give a synopsis. We'll try to hold our questions, unless they're absolutely burning, to the end if we can. And you can walk us through we have those in front of us also, your presentation. So if you would identify yourself, Commissioner, are you going to start?
I'll just start real quick.
Okay, Commissioner Hansen, welcome as well. Identify yourself for the tape, please.
Members of the committee, I'm Tom Hansen, Commissioner of Management and Budget. We're going to work off the charts that we used yesterday, but I also understand that you each have a big book that if we need to refer to it, as well as the summary book. So I think everybody, right, Jerry, has everything.
Yeah, I think our staff did run it off.
All right, I just wanted to start, Mr. Chairman, with the first chart to show you how we got add up, how we got to 1.203. The zero reflects the balanced budget we began the biennium with after the actions we took at the end of the last legislative session and the governor's actions. We actually carried forward $91 million less, and that that's a net number. It reflects less revenue received, and then we actually ended the 8 and 9 biennium with expenditures a little less than we thought. So it netted out to $91 million that less that we carried into this biennium that added to this deficit. You see the real story is the next number, 1.156. That is primarily income tax, and the actual income tax reduction that Dr. Stinson is going to talk about represents 70% of the overall deficit, and that's directly tied to wages, a decline in wages. And then we actually have lower spending to the tune of $44 million, Mr. Chairman, and that's how we get the $1.203 billion deficit. And with that, I'll turn it over to Dr. Stinson.
Dr. Stinson, welcome. Just one other announcement. Would people turn off their cell phones, please? Dr. Stinson, welcome.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, it's always a pleasure to be here, although I would prefer to bring you news if it was more money rather than less money.
Can you get a little bit closer to the mic? Is there someone that mm-hmm. makes up to
there is a body control. Is that better now?
Not much.
Not much.
And your mic is kind of right in the middle of the...
Yeah.
There we go.
Yeah, why don't we
there you go. That's better.
It's a question.
Mr. Chairman, the story is short and it's real simple. Revenues are down $1.156 billion.
about 3.7% from February's forecast after adjusting for legislative actions and the governor's executive actions over the summer. The largest part, as the commissioner said, is the income tax. In the official documents, it's about 70% of the decline, although, as I'll explain to you in a minute, it's actually a little bit more than that, since there are some changes in accounting characterizations that move money out of the other revenue and into the income tax. The reason is a weaker than projected economy. Now, from this point on, the story gets a little bit more complicated, because usually when we talk about a weaker than projected economy, we're talking about slower GDP growth than was projected otherwise. But in fact, that's not what's occurred. GDP growth is pretty well on track with what we expected, or what Global Insight expected in February of last year. The problem is the composition of that growth. More of the growth is coming in corporate profits than we expected, and so corporate income is up, and much, much less of it is coming in wages. And so wages are down compared to forecast. They're down historically. We've never seen these kinds of declines in wages in history, and that's what's affecting the income tax. Let me go through the revenues just real quickly here. The slide you have single page copies. You don't have two pages.
We can follow.
Okay.
The
slide that's projected anyway shows that the sales tax is off $32 million. The corporate income tax is up $54 million. Both are essentially wash each other out. The $32 million decline in the sales tax actually is due to higher than expected sales tax refunds, not weaker than expected sales tax receipts. And so we're actually showing a little bit of growth in gross receipts from the sales tax compared to February's forecast, which is good news, since we got to have that those purchases going and growing for the economy to keep on going. The income tax is down $827 million, 5.5% compared to the forecast. All other is down $351 million, or 5.4% compared to the forecast. The all other has, as I indicated, some items that really are kind of phantom changes in there. One is that up until now, reciprocity has been counted as a separate item in revenues and under all others. And now, because reciprocity is no longer with us for Wisconsin, that line has been eliminated. But the additional withholding that we will receive on individuals who live in Wisconsin but work in Minnesota is counted in the income tax. And so there's more than $100 million really that's been added to the income tax because of the change in treatment of reciprocity. And so compared to the end of session estimates, that means that the true income tax would have been down by more than $100 million more. In addition, there's compliance revenue, and that compliance revenue is no longer treated as a single item, but it's been apportioned out to the various tax categories, and that changes things as well. And so by the time you get all of these other things worked through, the income tax is about $1 billion short of where we were. We go to the next slide. This is, if there's good news in this scenario, in this presentation or this forecast, this is the good news. And the good news is that, unlike last November, and last February where we had no idea when the economy was going to turn around or if it ever would turn around. We were kind of in a free fall. And as you remember, Mr. Chairman, the pessimistic scenario was becoming the optimistic or the baseline scenario each month for a number of months. Since February, the economy has more or less followed the path that Global Insight thought it would. You can see here that, as I've taught you in the past, we're looking at the area between those two lines, and if the solid line is above the dotted line, that means that there should be more revenue. Now, we have a new forecast came in yesterday from Global Insight. The solid line is a little bit less further above the dotted line than it was before, but it's still above, and so we're still on track. It's just we're not quite as high as we would have been. But this is good news. The national economy has turned around. Global Insight does not expect a W-shaped double-dip recession. They expect a U-shaped recovery, a long, slow recovery, but a recovery nonetheless. And I think that's a big relief compared to where we were last November and certainly last February as well.
And I know we want to let Dexter, do you agree with Global Insight's assessment? Is it your opinion that we're not going to have a double dip, or that it's going to be a U-shape, it's going to take a lot? Do you agree with them on that, or do you differ?
No, I agree with them.
Okay.
I'm an optimist. Economics is the optimistic science. Everybody knows that. But I'm an optimist. I think we're not going to have the kind of recovery that we had coming out of the 1980, 81, 82 recessions. It's not going to be as steep as we've had in the past. But I think we are on the path to recovery. If you look at the next slide, you can see where we are. Black dot is where we are now. We're past the trough of the recovery. It's going to take us a long time to get back to where we were. And in past recessions, after 4 years of 4 years after the start of the recession, the economy's been about 10% higher than it was before. This time, we think 4 years after the end of the recession, we're going to be about 4% higher. And so it's going to be just a long, slow recovery. It's going to be especially slow in the labor area. In 2012, Global Insight still expects national unemployment to exceed 8%. This has been a really serious, serious economic decline, and I'll show you something that in a minute that to economists at least is pretty staggering in terms of the impact that the recession has had on household incomes and everybody's standard of living, basically. If you go to the next slide, Jim, this is what I was talking about. In February, Global Insight had a decline of 0.4% for 2009 over the year in wages. And this was a pretty nervy call. I mean, this was a pretty risky call because really never in history have wages declined year over year. We've had drops in the growth rate, but we've never had negative growth. We've never had an actual outright decline in wages. It's gone from 6% growth to 2% growth, but never from 2% growth to minus anything. And Global Insight was saying it was 0.4%. We were saying it was more. We were saying it was 1.4%, and we were pretty nervous about what was going on. Well, you can see from this graph that Global Insight and us as well we're optimists here, that what's actually happened is that wages are now projected to have fallen by 4.5%. Now, what I'm talking about here is total wages paid in the United States, not average wage paid or anything like that. This is the total check of all the checks that everybody gets in the U.S. is down 4.5%. That's really unprecedented. And if you look at the next slide here, you can see what I'm talking about. This goes from 1970 to 2012, but we could go back to 1950 or 1945 and the pattern would be the same. There's been one quarter where on a year-over-year basis wages have declined. Aside from that, we've always had increases, sometimes larger increases, sometimes smaller increases, but never actual declines like we've had. We've had three declines here. We are well on our way for the fourth decline, and Global Insight now believes that in the first quarter of 2010, we won't have a decline. We won't have five straight declines, but we'll have four straight declines. Mm-hmm. For Minnesota, we have the same kind of thing happening. If you go to the next slide, Jim. What you see here is our forecast for Minnesota wages. 2009, minus 1.4%. Now we have minus 5.5%. Why are we different? Why are we more pessimistic than the U.S., than Global Insight is for the U.S.? It's not because Minnesota's economy is necessarily worse than the U.S. economy or anything like that. It's because we have more information. We track wages for the state by looking at what happened to withholding tax receipts. And this is a chart that you don't have, but it shows what's happened to wages in Minnesota, the official wage data in Minnesota, and what's happened to withholding on a quarter-by-quarter basis. And you can see that there's a very close relationship. You can see this enormous decline that occurred in withholding and occurred in the official wage numbers. We now know withholding for the months of October and November. Nobody else does, obviously, but us. What we know is that we're going to have another very weak quarter of another very weak quarter of wages, an actual decline in wages in the fourth quarter of 2009. Now I want to
represent Holt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I apologize.
It's okay.
Dr. Stinson, can you speak to how much of that is attributable to unemployment versus stagnant or reduced either salaries or hours worked?
Sure. If you pull that chart back off, Jim, and leave the other one up, on the other side of this chart, now the one in your packet, oh no, it's on the top of it, okay, shows what's happened to employment as well. Okay, on the right-hand side, you can see what happened to employment. Okay, one way of thinking about it is of the 5.5% decline in wages, 4% of it is due to the decline in job growth, the fewer jobs. We had 4% fewer jobs, and so everybody had more or less the average wage on those jobs, then that would say that's 4% and 1.5% in fewer hours worked or average wage.
So, Dr. Stinson, even though our unemployment rate has dropped, that's because the denominator has dropped. There's less people looking for work as well. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, that's right. The unemployment rate, there are a lot of problems with the unemployment rate. It's a nice measure for the newspapers, but most economists don't pay very much attention to the unemployment rate because in part it comes from a very small sample. The jobs numbers are what we're really interested in and what people use in their forecasts. The unemployment rate is just something that you have to come up with. Now, I know that you all have a copy of the book as well, and I want you to turn to page 41. Okay, this is a part of income called non-farm proprietor's income, which is small business income, basically. Small business and partnership income, things like that. And you can see the same thing has happened with small business income. We actually have a decline, not a slower than usual growth rate, but an actual decline of more than 5% in small business income as well. So that's just an idea of how serious this problem has been. Again, this is income for all small businesses, all proprietors in the country. One of the things that affects our income tax as well. These are people who pay estimated taxes as opposed to have withholding taken from them in their check. And you can see what's happened to estimated tax payments over the last year. One of the questions is, well, how can you have GDP growth without having any growth in wages? How can you have GDP growth without having any growth in non-farm proprietors? The money has got to have gone somewhere. Where has it gone? And the answer is gone to corporate profits. That what's happened is that some of the massive losses that the financial institutions have been amassing are a little bit smaller. It's not that financial institutions are making tons of money or anything like that. It's just that they're not hemorrhaging money the same way that they had, and that's what's going on there. Well, that's the story of the forecast. I mean, there are a whole bunch of other vignettes that I could tell you, but that's the basic story. The basic story is that the income tax is well below what we thought it would be. The reason why is because wages and non-farm proprietors' incomes are at historic lows. I mean, what went on in 2009 is something that we haven't seen since World War II. That's what's driven the problem. We think that the economy has turned the corner, but it's not going to grow extremely rapidly over the next year or more. It's going to take a while for things to improve. But compared to last year at this time, compared to last February and March when I was before this committee, we're certainly in a lot better shape than we were in the economy at that time.
Okay, any particular questions at this particular point? Any questions? Representative Holbrook?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Stinson, do you have any data or information about any nuances between private sector jobs and public sector jobs?
Dr. Stinson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Holbrook, one of the things that we talked about yesterday was the difference in what had happened between wages in the private sector and wages in the public sector, and I didn't have that data with me at the time that you were asking that question. What's happened is for Minnesota, what we know is that private sector wages have fallen not by 5.5%, but by 6.5%. And that public sector wages, total wages, now this is not the average hourly wage or anything like that, has grown by a little bit less than 1%. That's that growth of a little bit less than 1% comes because not because of an increase in employment, but because of slightly higher average wage. Now, you can get a higher average wage by getting rid of part-time workers and so that you have just a higher average wage without raising their wages. But that's what the data shows.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Stinson, do we have any inkling at this time? And if not, when will we know what this report will do to our state's credit rating?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, typically, credit ratings don't change without us going to the without us selling bonds, without the state or somebody else actually going into the market to sell bonds. The credit rating agencies typically, not always, but typically only change the ratings at the time that you're issuing a new set of credits. And so the next time we issue bonds will be the next likely change.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we have a series of calls with the ratings agencies next week. We always brief them after our forecast. We don't have any bond sales planned at this time till next summer. So that's when we would be going and asking them for a rating.
Representative Biston?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do. And I can understand how our rating won't change until we actually ask for money. Right? My question is more looking at the state's economic outlook, number one, and looking at the ability of the state to accurately create forecasts. Now, this forecast is wildly different from the last one. Is that going to have an effect on our credit rating as well if we're not able to accurately forecast our financial outlook?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Biskins, we're known and respected for our ability to forecast. And this is just anecdotally, I ran into one of the top people at one of the rating agencies this summer in a casual conversation, and he was actually telling somebody else about how well we forecast and how it's independent from the political process and how he wished other states were more to do the job like Dr. Stinson does. So I'm pretty confident that you'd have to look far and wide to find a better process than this.
Representative Carlson?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I've got a question about sector activity and or employment. Dr. Stinson, when we met with you prior to the recession, you focused in an informal discussion we had about housing. And there's been a fair amount of publicity, and I guess I'm talking about construction generally, but there's been a fair amount of publicity that we've had an increase in housing activity now, but that's in part due to the tax credit that's available to home buyers, and that's going to stop, and we may again see a drop, or a W, if you will, in the construction industry. And if you could comment on what you see there, because you thought that was a real key to the threshold of the recession last time. And then I have a follow-up question, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, I've talked recently with people in the housing industry, big builders and so on like that, and they are cautiously optimistic about 2010. Now, when I say cautiously optimistic, they say they think they're going to increase production some over what they had in 2009. But you have to understand, and they understand, that when we're talking about increasing production over 2009, that in 2008 we had nationally about 900,000 units constructed, which was the lowest number of housing units constructed since World War II. And in 2009, we had about 550,000 units constructed, it looks like, which is half or almost 60% of the unit, the lowest number of units we had constructed since World War II. These guys are well aware of the fact that if they were to increase their production by 50%, and they're not going to increase their production by 50%, it would still be the second worst year of housing construction since World War II. So we're talking about a situation where you can have huge percentage increases and still be well below the level that you had in 2008.
And Mr. Chairman, my other question, you mentioned that economists look at the jobs numbers, and what comes to my mind is underemployment, the number of workers, even though they're technically employed, instead of working the 40 hours a week, are working 25 or 30, and if you could comment on the underemployment question.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, the official measure that you read in the paper is something called the U3 unemployment level. There are other measures of unemployment that take into account discouraged workers, that take into account people who are working less than full-time for economic reasons, the situation you described, which is that they would like to be working 40 hours a week, but they can't find a job that works that provides full-time employment. If you look at that number is about, for the national economy, is about 17.6% in the economy. So it's fewer than, or more than one person out of six is either unemployed, underemployed, or a discouraged worker.
And Dr. Stinson, would you have to have a number for Minnesota then when we talk about the underemployed? If you do, fine. If you don't,
Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, there is no official number for the states. The states don't produce that number. However, one of my staff was concerned about this issue, and if you turn in the book to page, let's see, to page 25, there's a section where he discusses the underemployment and underutilization, and at the top of page 26, he says that by his estimates, the underutilization of the state's labor force is about 15%. Now, again, these aren't official numbers like the numbers for the U.S. These are numbers that are based on our calculations, but it is a severe problem.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Hilke?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Stinson, could you elaborate a little bit on what is driving a current increase in GDP and how that ultimately is expected to relate to an economic recovery in terms of wages and general well-being for the populace?
Dr. Stinson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hilke, the current increases in GDP, GDP is the sum of consumer spending plus business spending plus government spending plus net exports plus the change in inventory. Okay. In the most recent quarter, the third quarter, consumer spending was up in part because of cash for clunkers. It was up part because of the first-time home buyers credit. It was up in part because of the fiscal, another part of the fiscal stimulus package, which created construction jobs for people and provided income for people to spend. It was up in part because of another part of the stimulus package, which lowered everybody's withholding tax slightly, and so we had just a small amount more money to spend each week. All of those factors caused consumer spending to be up. Business investment spending is not up, is down. Government spending has been up and is part of that growth again. Net exports, I think, were more or less a wash. It didn't really make much difference. And then there was a change in inventory in the decline in inventories that added to it. And the two big pieces were this consumer spending that was driven by the fiscal stimulus package largely and inventories. Okay, looking on out into the future, the current quarter, we don't have cash for clunkers, we don't have first-time home buyers, and the expectation is that GDP is not going to grow as fast as it did with those. We still have the stimulus money going for infrastructure. We still have the stimulus money going for, or not stimulus money, but the stimulus package related tax cuts. And so those are still there, and those are still going to be providing some stimulus. And what we expect to see is a smaller decline in inventories, and that will provide us with growth in the fourth quarter. The same kind of thing in the first quarter as well. And what's hoped, and you know, this is the big hope, obviously, but what's hoped is that the growth, the decline in that, once the inventories hit this low part, low point, they get as low as they can go with it, as retailers start replenishing the stock of inventories on their shelves, that will create a demand for additional activity, additional manufacturing goods that will come about. The second piece of stimulus or aid to the economy is expected to come through a lower value of the dollar. The value of the dollar has been getting lower and lower. That means that U.S. goods are cheaper purchases by foreign nationals, and so we expect to see a little bit of help out of exports as well. And so those are the two things. In the forecast that we have, federal government spending is actually expected to be a drag on the economy because it's expected to fall below, to be less than it had been over the prior year in there. And so,
can you repeat that?
That federal government spending is expected to be a drag on the economy because it's expected to be lower than in the prior year. So all the stimulus is going to go away. It's not going to provide any more support. And the question is, what do we have going 6 months from now? Have we got enough momentum going 6 months from now so that we'll be able to continue to go without the additional federal spending?
Haber, Representative Haber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner Hansen, I just really liked Commissioner Wheelock's report way better when she had boatloads of money. Anyway, so I realize you're just a messenger. I think it's a commissioner problem. Could you just comment, Dr. Stinson, on the state-by-state, just how we fare with our five state partners? I know California, I don't want to be compared to them. I think they're way worse. We'll be happier hearing about that probably. But, like, how does the Sun Belt doing? Can you just give a little short thing about that? I think that'd be helpful.
Dr. Stinson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Abler, to the west and south, the economies are doing better than we are. North Dakota is one of the states that's doing much better than the national average. South Dakota, Iowa both have lower unemployment rates than we do. I can't remember off the top of my head Wisconsin's unemployment rate, but I think it's higher than ours. But in the group of states that we're normally grouped with, which is called the West-North Central region, we are the highest of the unemployment rates, but that region has North Dakota, South Dakota, Nebraska, Kansas, which are states that have extremely low unemployment rates at this point. In terms of expected growth, Global Insight put out something yesterday or the day before, something which I haven't seen. All I've seen is just a map, and we're ranked about 30th on that map. And I don't know what the characteristics, what they're how they're doing this ranking or anything like that. I just had a call from a newspaper reporter that asked me about it, and I told her to ask them about what drove this, and she said she'd get back to me, and she didn't get back to me yesterday for some reason. But
30.
Yeah.
Okay, follow up.
Well, first is better than 50th, and so 30th is.
There's an optimist menu again.
Yeah. So the states that are doing better than Minnesota tend to be the states, again, immediately to our west, the mountain states, the plain states, so on like that. States that are doing worse than Minnesota are the industrial Midwest and the far west, the California, Nevada, Arizona, Oregon, Washington, in this. So.
And I appreciate
follow-up.
That. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you just give a personal opinion about why Minnesota is not doing as well as some of our people that we're grouped with?
And you never have to give personal opinions if you don't want.
Thank you. Fair enough.
Mr. Chairman, if I knew what was being measured by this thing, I might have a personal opinion, but since I don't know what it is that they're measuring at this point, the reporter will get back to me and you'll read it in the paper in another week or something like that.
Okay. Representative Nelson. Representative Kahn and Carlson have that. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Stinson. We've been doing a lot of talking about bonding, doing student job creation programs. What kind of effect or how much do we need to do? Is there a rule of thumb when we spend money for bonding and that, as far as how much money it takes to create a job? I mean, because there's a lot of people out of work. How much are we looking at if we have to do a job? And I've got a follow-up question.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, yesterday I said there was a rough rule of thumb that it takes about $100,000 to create a job for repair and renovation, just an asset preservation. You don't get $100,000, or you don't get a job for $100,000 if you're building highway or something where there are big land acquisition costs or anything like that. My $100,000 rule of thumb was for asset preservation. For larger projects, for big capital projects, the number is much larger. Depends upon land acquisition costs. It depends upon materials costs and things like that as well. And I wouldn't want to venture a guess as to what it would be. The $100,000 number, though, that I said yesterday, was a number that was limited to asset preservation types of activities.
I think you answered my follow-up question. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Kahn?
Yes, actually, I now have a follow-up question to that one, but let me ask my original one. The Federal Reserve Quarterly, which came out fairly recently, or still in the spread-out stack of mail on my table at home, had they had a whole bunch of indicators which had Minnesota looking very much better than all of the surrounding states. And I think it was household income or something like that. Is that... Yeah, sorry, I didn't bring it with me. I'm putting in a
pile. Chairman Representative, Representative Congress, Minnesota personal income per capita and household income and all these kinds of measures. Minnesota does much better than the surrounding states. Minnesota, depending upon the year and what measure you are, is somewhere 9, 10, 11, something like that, nationally among states in income. If you look at measures like unemployment rate or something like that, then North Dakota, Nebraska, some of those states have noticeably lower unemployment rates than Minnesota. And so it's kind of, what is it that you're looking at that's the issue?
But of course, all of, Mr. Chairman, all of those things depend on the denominator. And I think all of us know that anyone who's unemployed in North Dakota and is looking for a job probably comes from Minnesota. So we all know people starting from Martin Sabo's family and all sorts of other people who've done that through the years. So any small denominator gets the per capita, you know, goes way up in terms of that. But the other question I had, I wanted to follow up on this $100,000 rough estimate creates a job. Once that job is created, is there any computation of what that figures into that $100,000 as to what the taxes paid by the person who gets that job, if that person comes off public things, like, of course, if they're not, they may be federal programs. They come off federal state assistance programs or federal assistance programs like food stamps or something. Is there any estimate as to how someone having a job impacts the economic system once we've created that job?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Tan, a couple of points here. The first is the $100,000 doesn't all go to the individual.
Sure.
Okay. Maybe half of that money goes to the individual in form of wages and benefits. And so we're talking about a much smaller number than $100,000.
If I can
and then
interrupt that, too. The other half goes to something that is hopefully making a profit on that, too. So,
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kahn, yes, but that may be a paint company that's located in Pittsburgh or some place like that and not a Minnesota manufacturer or a Minnesota... some of it goes through the distributor.
Yeah.
But there are pretty good-sized leakages that occur in purchases like that. So of that... $50,000 then, to the extent that this just replaces unemployment insurance payments, or that most of it replaces unemployment insurance payments, it wouldn't make a difference because unemployment insurance is also taxable in the income tax. To the extent that it replaces food stamps and other non-cash compensation that aren't counted in there, it would. And I don't know of any estimates that have been made that would say that you would get 7% or 6% of the $50,000 back in higher taxes. I mean, that is the maximum you get back would probably be 6 or 6.5%, and so that would be what $3,000 in there.
Representative Hausman, to this point.
Represent Khan's issue, when we toured around the state, when we arrived in Duluth, the contractor at the Duluth Convention Center handed us a sheet. We had not asked for it, and it detailed all of their vendors. And what they were showing us is, with only two exceptions, every one of their vendors was from Minnesota. Now, clearly, they had made a conscious decision about this and were telling us about that. And so it is, I mean, I think all of our partners around the state are beginning to understand their role. I mean, we all sort of have a responsibility in this, I think, and we all can do a little bit. So I thought that was a helpful answer to your question. The other, on the issue of that $100,000 for jobs for asset preservation, at our jobs task force this week, MinSU made their presentation. They probably are doing a better job than anyone right now in terms of really responding to some of these jobs issues. And they would agree that that asset preservation number is certainly better than land purchase or something else. But they also said that if you build a new building, you put even more people to work, just because there are that many more kinds of trades and contracts. So if any of you are interested in that, I thought I could just run up and get that page that shows their experience.
It just takes longer.
Yes.
From the beginning to get to that point.
They would stay employed longer, certainly.
Yeah. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this goes again to that kind of bounces off that $100,000 per job. Dr. Stenson, although I don't know that it's been said outright, but it's been implied that our cities are going to, I'll just phrase it this way, our cities are going to be worried about their LGA coming, I think it's December or January. Do you have any measure of the $100,000 or what a cut in LGA would cost in public employees at the city level? So if, I think there's $400 million out there, if the governor was to cut a lot, $100 million of that, would that translate into 1,000 jobs and so forth? Is there some measure there that you might have or could share?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, we don't have that kind of a measure. And again, it would depend upon what the city decided to do to make up that loss. You know, if it's all layoff, then I'm sure that people from the cities can tell you what their average wage and benefits would be. But if you don't buy a new Xerox copier or something like that, then it doesn't have that kind of wages. So it really depends upon how things are how the cutbacks are managed.
Representative Rukamina, and then goes live to Mr. Showalter.
I think it was last month that I had seen that there were 200.
Can you use your mic a little bit?
I think it was last month, for the month of October maybe, that we lost 230,000 jobs in this country, and 26,000 of them happen to be teachers, either local or state teachers. And in fact, you know, it's kind of stunning that since the beginning of last summer, the estimates are 170,000 teachers have lost their jobs in this country. So let's just assume that we have a $1.2 billion deficit and that we have to address in this biennium. And will somebody answer the phone?
It's Alice's phone. She was supposed to, she didn't hear my message to turn it off. She will when she comes back.
We have the $1.2 billion deficit, and then we can't reach an agreement on the $2.7 billion that the governor illegally unallotted. So if you add them up, $4 billion, how many jobs does that equate that we'd lose in either the private sector at our hospitals, let's say, or the public sector?
Dr. Stenson, want to take a stab at that?
Representative Rukavina, you know, it's the same answer that had to give Representative Mahoney, and that is that it depends upon how that's managed. You can manage it so that there would be less jobs lost. There's certainly going to be jobs lost, or you know, the maximum is you take the average and plug it in. And so it really depends upon how it's managed in there. Certainly, we would expect it would be a significant number of jobs. So.
and finally, if you look at the projections from yesterday, and you have a $5.4 billion shortfall, and then you add inflation in, which, you know, I really wish we would quit using Enron accounting practices, at 1.2, and then you don't pay back the recognition shift or the fix for GAMC, you're really at about $8 billion if I'm not mistaken, looking at a real numbers for the next biennium. So I don't know what the population of California is. Maybe you do. Are we like number one in the nation if we use real numbers in per capita debt? As Representative Abler implied, that we weren't as bad off as California, but if I'm not mistaken, California has close to, what, 30 million people. Are we really number one if we look at real numbers?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rubicina, no, California is number one. They have a firm grasp on that.
Are we number two?
I don't know about number two, but I doubt if we're number two even.
Well, we must be getting close.
Representative Mariani, one more question.
At least California has an ocean, so you can spend time on the beach when you're... Dr. Simpson, I'm just looking on page 24 of the big report, which shows the Minnesota employment change by industry. And part of this is sort of to make a point, but also to ask the question. So the only sector that's shown any kind of employment growth is education and health services, and I see that as being distinct from government sector. So 2.6% growth, and you know, on the one hand, as you know, someone who works in education, that's comforting to me, because I always think that's just a good long-term investment that we make as a people in terms of education. But the question is, a couple questions: is that a national pattern? Is that And one, and two, has that been driven primarily from the stimulus funds?
Let's ask those two questions first, if we can.
Well, and Mr. Chair, what I wanted to get at then is the sustainability then of that pattern in Minnesota.
Okay. Dr. Benson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mariani, that category of education and healthcare services is a category that is dictated by the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, that every state reports in that category, in that combined category. And again, this is private education. This is not public education.
Oh,
there's no public education in there. Okay. One of the things that's deceptive about this category is, and I'm looking for the material right now. That most of the growth, not all of the growth, but most of the growth is in the healthcare area. It's not in the private educational services. And so really when you look at this, the way to think about it is that that's more or less flat. And it's the healthcare part that's growing. Now there's a little bit of growth in the private educational services, but most of it is in the healthcare side.
Okay, Representative Clark, and then I do want to get to Mr. Schwartz.
To this point, is the healthcare part of that also only private healthcare, or is that all healthcare?
Private healthcare, in that it's private nonprofit, so it would include Hennepin County Medical Center or something like that.
It would include or would not include?
Would. That's my impression. It would include, you know, the big hospitals and things like that that are private nonprofit.
And if, you know, does it not include then Medicare, Medicaid?
Anybody that's employed by Medicare, by the, whatever the federal agency is, would be counted as. This is an employment. This isn't an expenditure.
Yeah.
Okay, but before we begin, Representative Hausman, will you turn off your cell phone? Yeah.
Can I just get clarification on that last point? Dr. Simpson, wouldn't it be true, though, if places like hospitals, nursing homes, even if they're privately owned but heavily funded by government health care programs, they would be still considered private sector jobs, but heavily supported by government spending. Is that not true?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Colbert, yes, that's exactly right. That it doesn't matter where the money comes from. It's whether they are part of state government or local government or not.
All right, thank you.
Okay, Mr. Showalter, the director of the budget, you bring us some good news. even though it may be small. Yeah, Representative Hauser?
Because I referenced two things, they're back-to-back. The loose sheet that we got is on the back side, and the ministry numbers are on the front, and close to.
Thank you. Okay, Mr. Showalter, do you want to continue on?
Mr. Chair, thank you. For the record, my name is Jim Showalter, State Budget Director, and I'm going to take you through briefly the forecast side of this forecast. But before I do, I just want to make a little transition from the economy discussion that we've been having. And just want to reference a couple things that might be of the committee's interest.
21%.
One is there has been some work done the Rockefeller Institute on states, just looking at how state governments and state budgets in particular have made their way out of past recessions. Some of that information just suggests very clearly that state budgets do not respond nearly as quickly as changes in the GDP. So that even with the somewhat hopeful news that the GDP is starting to stabilize and maybe even grow, that does not mean that Minnesota state budget or other state budgets are likely to start seeing much relief for as many as 3 to 5 years, if past trends have any indication of what this current situation. In fact, current factors probably make it a little worse than that. So there's been a little bit of research on that. It might be of interest to you. The other thing I just wanted to mention is that this isn't an official document or all that analytical. It's fairly subjective, but we're talking about what's happening in other states. And you know, before coming over here, I just printed off a series of what's happening in other states, that email that came to us. And if you'd like, you can play a game and pick a letter as to, just so that there's no selective news here, but it's bad. Just one state after another, whether it's the revenue updates that they've put out, whether it's some of the budget moves that they've had to do, it is the amount of bad news coming from other states is really quite substantial, and it just continues to happen based upon the revenue changes. You're seeing sales tax weakness and income tax weakness and changes from their earlier projections in a number of places. So I can leave this with Jerry if you want to just peruse.
That'd be very good. We'll make sure members get it available for them.
Great. To the forecast itself, the slide that you have before you shows very little change in spending overall in 2010 and 11 in this forecast. A slight decline in the estimated number of pupils responsible for the change in the K-12 education number. Property tax days and credits, health and human services numbers are actually pretty consistent with earlier estimates, with the exception of some of the things that are going on in Minnesota Care and GAMC, which I'll come to in a second. Debt service reduction is follows pretty naturally from what Dr. Stinson was talking about. Interest rates are really quite low right now. As a result, the premiums that we've gotten on new bond sales yield some short-term benefits, along with the opportunity to refund some bonds yield some further debt service savings. So all in all, the spending is pretty consistent. Slightly lower debt service, slightly higher health and human services numbers, and the health and human services numbers are really driven by an evolving relationship between the Health Care Access Fund and the General Fund. You've seen it in past forecasts where we've had some transfers between those two funds. In this instance, we've got not only the transfers of funds that are in current law, but also the line item veto and unallotment of funding for the General Assistance Medical Care Program. And the assumption in this forecast is that many of those people will start to show up in the Minnesota Care Program, that with a auto enrollment that you're going to have nearly 30,000 people adding to the already growing population that's already coming into Minnesota Care, leading to financial transactions between those two funds. So that's really the spending story. On the next slide, I'll just walk through some of the key factors that are inside the forecast. Even inside this, though there's not a huge net change, the first item is just the governor's unallotments and executive actions. Those are included as part of the reference points for this forecast. So when we're talking about change in this forecast, we're talking about change from end of legislative session along with any line item vetoes, along with any unallotments or other governor's executive actions being the point of reference in changing on spending or revenue.
Mr. Zoalter, the first bullet that you have, you have the complete repayment of K-12 school aid is deferred into the next biennium. That will require legislative action, is that correct?
Yes. The complete repayment of the K-12 deferral of $1.17 billion is assuming that there will be obviously some legislative action in the next biennium setting up the budgets for those the school budgets. This is really a forecast, again, trying to tackle that very, frankly, ticklish question of what is the likely impact of deferring payments out of this biennium on next biennium's budget.
And in the second part of that, the property tax recognition shift is assumed that that will not be paid off in the next biennium as well, right?
Mr. Chair, that is correct. It's a different tool that was used. In that instance, the Commissioner of Education instructed the school districts to recognize that revenue in a different manner than had been previously done. So there's no action that would necessarily revert us back to the prior practice.
But to be honest with them, in the next biennium, if you're going to repay one in the next biennium and the other one, you could add to the deficit that $562 million that's in the next biennium. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, yeah, we tried to give you all of the moving pieces. This is an unusual forecast with a number of major issues that are before you. Not all of, I think, are seen in the same way. There's some conflicting pieces of legislation, conflicting concepts, so we tried to make sure that it was all in front of you.
Thank you. Continue on.
The second item that we show here is the line item veto of the General Assistance Medical Care Program, as I mentioned before. That leads to some auto enrollment of the General Assistance Medical Care enrollees into the Minnesota Care Program. While that fund was already anticipated to run into a deficit, even absent any General Assistance Medical Care action by the end of the next biennium, this additional group of enrollees is going to cause that fund to go negative in 2011. So as a result, that negative balance in 2011 invokes another piece of current statute, which says that the general fund in 2010 and 11 shall make sure that there's sufficient funds to cover Minnesota care expenditures during that biennium, and only that biennium. That leads to the $111 million transfer that you see in this forecast.
In that particular accounting, automatically there was, I think, $48 million, I want to say a year, is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
That was transferred from the Health Care Access Fund to the General Fund, and it's been in existence probably since the interaction of that, or the establishment of that fund. Does that, the 111, include the 48, or is that in addition to the 48 cost of the general fund?
Mr. Chair, that's in addition.
So that's the real cost for the general fund and for that action of those people going into the to Health Care Access Fund would be 159, is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that's certainly a good start. There's a number of moving pieces here, and I've talked with Mr. Marks very briefly, and I think we'll try to get a consensus opinion here. But there's both those transfers. There's also changes in revenues associated with the DISH payments that are involved here. Forecast growth in expenditures, all that gets you to a net total.
Good. Representative Ruth, convenience to that point?
Yeah, to that point.
Can you use your mic as well?
Commissioner Hanson, and I'm not, you know, that well-versed in Minnesota care. I don't sit on the Health and Human Service Committee, but is there a place in statute that allows the governor to shift people from GAMC into Minnesota care?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rukavina, the... I'm not as familiar with the actual particulars of human services, but as you know, the GMC program got unallotted, and
right.
I think there's something. It's allowable to enroll them. There are people who qualify for Minnesota care that just haven't enrolled.
But they weren't, Mr. Chair and Commissioner, they weren't on Minnesota care because they weren't working, and I think that was part of the requirement. So they're on general assistance. So doesn't the governor have to have some statutory language to take people off of general assistance medical coverage and put them on Minnesota Care?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Rucamina, the Minnesota Care doesn't have a working requirement. It's generally identified as the program, you know, a program that pays premiums and for people
but it's not nothing
in statute or in rules that say somebody has to have a job to be on Minnesota Care.
I thought, yes, maybe I'm mistaken, but I thought they had to pay for part of their premium.
Well, they do.
So if you're not working, you get money in the sky, or
file.
Well, but that's not my question to the argument. The question is, where does it say in statute that you can move somebody, that the governor can move someone from GAMC to Minnesota Care?
Mr. Stowalls, do you want to try to give a stab at that question?
I will try to, Mr. Chair. Representative, I don't believe there is a specific statute that says that people should be enrolled in Minnesota Care. I think what you're looking at is a population that's dually eligible, that they're eligible for GAMC as well as Minnesota Care. And the question is, how should we treat, what is the operational impact of the line item veto and the lack of funding that's there? Or how do you treat the forecast anticipated impact of what's clearly a standoff?
Well,
Representative Rucamina,
Chair and members, it would seem to me that, you know, that there would need to be some language to do this. But aside from that, then, money, they do have to still pay the sliding fee. And since they have no money, then the counties have been ordered to do that. And so where does it say in statute that the counties have to pay for Minnesota
Mr. Chair, Representative, we don't have the statute here, but I certainly can talk with the Department of Human Services, because that is within, it's our understanding that was within their statutory.
Mr. Showalter, just on that same issue, not everybody that's eligible for GMC or is on the program is going to be going into Minnesota Care. Some of them would not be. Is that correct?
I believe, Mr. Chair, I believe that is correct.
And so how many, what percentage, I understood about 75% would be going into Minnesota Care. Is that roughly 25%? Welcome to the committee. We always get sidetracked on this, but it's a good sidetrack to have.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Christine Goodell for the record from MND. Virtually all of the, my understanding is that virtually all of the individuals who are currently enrolled in general assistance medical care will be auto-enrolled into transitional Minnesota care for a certain period.
So, isn't there a waiting period?
Not in this case. Not in this case.
Well, Mr. Chair, I was going to get to it. Thank you.
Representative Rucamina?
I'm sorry, I didn't get... I'm going to ask... You can whisper at Hanson there. You can't say the big bucks.
So, actually, with salary compression, you think what I'm...
Well, so, is there something in statute that says there isn't a three-month waiting period for people to enroll in Minnesota Care?
Representative Rucavina, my understanding is that the Human Services Department has the authority to auto-enroll current GAMC enrollees into transitional Minnesota Care.
So,
Representative Rucavina,
just so I understand, so my neighbor is working two jobs at $7 an hour, and if they want to enroll their kids and himself on Minnesota Care, he has to wait 3 months, but...
Form,
whatever it is. But the governor's decided these other folks can immediately qualify. Is that what you're telling me?
Mr.
Mr. Hanson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rucavina, and we're in the seventh year of our term, and we've been trying to reform the GAMC program from its double-digit increases every year. And we, in vain, tried to get to the point where we were going to reform the program, and we were shunned.
by the legislature, so the governor had to take the action.
Well, Commissioner, hold on a second.
Oh, just a minute. Let's go.
Well, that's not the question.
No, Representative Ruth Covina. Well, everyone take a deep breath. Okay, Representative Ruth Covina, after you've taken your deep breath.
I wasn't yelling.
Well, that's horrible for you.
You know. I have a special gift, I guess. I don't.
Let's try to work to the chair if you can.
As my neighbor who's working two minimum wage jobs and working part-time and qualifies for Minnesota Care and trying to get on, is being told he's having trouble on trying to help out, and they have to wait 4 months, even though they qualify, but the governor's decided this other population doesn't have to wait.
He's talking about care help.
Mr. Chair and Representative Rukovina, currently individuals who are enrolled in general assistance medical care also transition into transitional Minnesota care with no break in coverage.
Finally, Commissioner Hanson, what's the estimate again, the cost that the counties will have to pay for the premiums, the sliding scale premiums for these folks? What's the cost going to be on property taxes, or I suppose that's the only place they can go? So what's the cost?
We would need a, Mr. Chairman, Representative Rukovina, we need an estimate of the
$4. So, and just you know, to get them riled up again, Mr. Chair, it's been 7 years that you've had deficits out of aid, and you haven't addressed it. We've been trying to address it.
Okay, Representative Carlson?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Commissioner Hanson, you've indicated to us in the past that you were going through a planning process on this transition, and I've had some conversations with some of the hospital people and so on, and when you go through this transition, I think it's important that people understand that there are differences in the program, and one of the big differences is the $10,000 cap, and as one of your other commissioners, the Commissioner of Health and Human Services, pointed out, we're talking about the poorest of the poor. But there's that $10,000 cap, and when they come into the system, in talking to a couple of constituents, you can have one weekend hospitalization, quite frankly, and you can hit the $10,000 cap. And so then the next step in this whole process is that the hospitals, which are required to provide the care, are going to have to eat that cost, and we call that the uncompensated care. And, you know, in my area, it's HCMC, I'm a Hennepin County legislator, but I also have North Memorial in my district, which is right on the Minneapolis line. It's located in southern Robbinsdale, and they service, because of the demographics on the near north side, a lot of high poverty, low income people. And so my question is, have you, with this planning process that we've talked about for some time, addressed those kinds of issues? Because that's one hospitalization. We're talking about people, by the way, and I've had a lot of conversations on this, that not only are they in poverty, but their health care needs are higher than the general population. And I remember when we debated this on the House floor, something like 40% of the people that are on GAMC are mentally ill and require frequent hospitalization. And then I won't even go into what the cost might be in terms of other social services as a result of they're not getting appropriate medical care and so on, increased calls by the police and so on, as some people that may not have their medications any longer when they reach that cap. So are you addressing that issue? And by the way, for those people that are viewing this, when we talk about uncompensated care, about every health policy in the state of Minnesota, on average, is about $1,000 more due to uncompensated care, and we're going to be aggravating that. So we're really talking about a shift onto an awful lot of citizens in addition to the hospitals.
Mr. Chairman,
Mr.
Representative Carlson, it is true that GMC is a better benefit cut, and that when you do transfer into Minnesota Care, you do have the $10,000 limit. It is an imperfect solution, and ideally we come up with some other solution to that population. The deficit that we announced yesterday makes that more difficult, but ideally you figure something else out.
Well, Mr. Chairman, just quickly, my basic question was that we've been told in the past you were going through a planning process, and it sounds like you haven't addressed that issue then yet in terms of how you're going to handle that. And I know it's a major concern by the hospitals, as I mentioned earlier. And I think if you're going to move in that direction, those are questions that you have to answer before we can... as you point out, you've been raising this question with the legislature for a long time. Well, there's good reason why the legislature hasn't gone along with what you've proposed, and I think I've identified at least two of them here this morning. So if you're going to continue to push for that, I think you have to answer those basic questions. Then I'll just stop there, Mr. Chairman.
Commissioner Hanson, do you want to respond to that? Or
Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, Texas, talk to Commissioner Ruderman at DHS.
Thank you.
Well, Representative Rukavina, very quickly, follow up.
No, Mr. Chairman, yeah. Really too.
Okay. Representative Winkler.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I'd like to just for a second return to this question that Representative Rukavina was raising but didn't explicitly ask, which is, do you have statutory authority for auto enrollment? Is there a specific statutory authority, or is the action in conflict with existing state statutes? And the direct question, whether the action is legal or illegal, and the follow-up suggestion would be that when you present in the future, you may want to come armed with specific statutory authority, because I think there is significant question in this body about whether the governor's actions through his administration, through unalignment and other things, has actually been consistent with the law. So I think it's going to be a burden for you to carry to indicate to us that you actually have the authority. I'd like a specific answer, if possible.
Mr. Showalter, do you need to have some research done on that and provide that to us?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we can do some more research on it. Certainly, we believe, and DHS believes, that they have statutory authority, but it sounds like there's some question over that, and we should all take a look.
Would you provide that in writing to the chair, and the chair will make sure that it gets out to everybody. Then Representative Thiessen.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of one point. I'm glad to hear that the administration is working on some alternative proposal to the Minnesota Care transition. It sounds like you were just indicating we are having a hearing on the 14th of December, and you're certainly invited to come in and present those options. I know that the House Republicans are going to have a proposal that they're going to present to us, and we're going to have a proposal. Huntley's in my committee is having a hearing. We've talked to the commissioner, but I wasn't aware that there was actually going to be a proposal beyond what the governor had already talked about. But we'll look forward to that. And I also need to say, Mr. Chair, I wasn't in the room exactly, but I hear there was testimony that the administration was in all last year pushing on their GMC reform proposal. And if I recall correctly, we never even actually got a fiscal note from your area on what that proposal would look like. So I think, just to make sure we keep the record straight here, I think there was one hearing where they came in, and then we heard nothing from the administration after their budget came out on that proposal. And so I don't think that's really a fair characterization. I think we need to have that on the record.
Representative Rukavina.
Sure, thank you. And Commissioner Hanson, if you could get that number to the committee on what you think the estimate is on property tax increases because of the shift, this enrolling, if you get us that number. And secondly, Commissioner, I've been going to campuses Minsk, worried about the effects of what's going to happen when we don't have a stimulus package to backfill them. Like we did this past session. And I found out that Minnesota, whenever it is, the Department of Finance, has taken $300 million, I think was the number of the $500 million that Minsky had in reserve. And I asked and I, my understanding, I asked at St. Cloud Tech yesterday, you know, how much they had in reserve, and they said they had $9 million that they had put aside, and it's held by the state and invested short term. And they don't know the status of it now, and they, you know, had been saving up to pay their one half of the one third that Minsky pays for a new building that they had been hoping to get. So how are they going to get that money back? And when are they going to get that $300 million supposedly you borrowed from Minsky from the kid's tuition? And when are you going to, and someone was told they were going to, you were going to pay interest. So how are you going to pay the $300 million back and then pay interest on the $300 million?
Well, Representative Rukavina, I'm going to defer the question a little bit because I want to concentrate on the GMC, and then that goes into a cash flow situation. So,
thanks, Mr. Chair. I have to leave for a while.
That's okay.
So could you
we'll make sure that we'll figure out the answers, because I think that is a good, important question. So, Representative Aver.
Thanks. Mr. Rukavina leaves. There's plenty of opportunity to discuss these things in the Human Service Committee. I think if, with your seniority, you could request a spot there. The Speaker, I think, would create a spot for you on that committee. If you could come help us out, I think that'd be great. So,
okay.
On the Human Service.
Let's go to the question.
Anyway, whatever.
Representative Aver.
I'm not sure where you were today. The Minnesota Care GMC thing has really been a tough challenge. And I, just before I even offer my thoughts about that, it's there are still a lot of nerves really raw from the end of last session for all kinds of reasons, and I think that we're going to have to move away from that position of standing around and being mad if we're going to get through this thing. We've been handed a very difficult hand to play. With this new forecast, and the problems that we thought we had last time now are smaller than they are today. And just to encourage everybody in that direction, the Minnesota Care thing, the staff didn't discuss it very quickly, but the transitional Minnesota Care program is when you get GMC after the person who's uninsured, who's poor, with their issues, hits their head and they're bleeding, they go to the hospital, they get enrolled for 6 months. Steeper service for the first month and a half or so, then Health Partners or somebody gets $900 a month for the balance of 6 months to capitate their care. And the hospitals get paid below retail to serve these people, and it comes out of this pot. And the plans lost $30 million aggregate last year in their GEMC book of business. So it's a tough population to serve, and we make them be in this business to get the state employees and be MA providers if they're health HMO plans. So that's, nobody wins this deal, and it's a hard deal. It's the only 100% state money, pot of money, that was available. I thought it would create dialogue with the, I didn't tell the governor to veto it, by the way. I wouldn't have picked that one, but I thought, just in my world, it would create dialogue. It created, not dialogue. Anyway, you all know how the session ended, but here we are, and so as we're broker, the 6 month transitional thing, the department thinks they can do it. I don't know if they can. I think they think they can. At least it's humane to do it. And so they get to then get this Minnesota Care for the balance of their 6 months. So if they hit their head January 1st, their care expires June 30th, and so the transitional Minnesota Care hits March 1st and goes till the end of June. If at the end of June they can fill out a form and pay $4 a month, they get to have their care continue. I estimate 28,000 people at $4 a head per month is about $100,000+ hit on the counties, which is money, but it's not much money. I don't know who's going to pay after how that's worked out. But anyway, that's just background for the members, and this is really a hard thing to figure out. It's an urban problem more than there's some regional centers that have problems with this, but it's really an urban
problem. No, it's not just an urban problem. I mean, it's maybe more population there, but
yeah.
My hospitals are also very, very concerned about the uncompensated charity care that's coming through the door and some of the effective programs that, like IM Care in Itasca County, is very, very concerned about. They'll lose that particular cost-effective program. So it is a state-wide program.
I was just overgeneralizing. Sorry. Yeah, but you're correct, and I agree with you. But I just had a question about the math on the healthcare access fund.
Okay.
The with do you What percentage, do you know what percentage of the people you expect of these 28,000 are going to continue on after they get out of their 6 months thing? Does somebody know, what is it, like 70-80% you figure?
5% is what I found out yesterday.
That's what they...
Okay, let's see if we can have someone from the administration answer the question. What percent will continue on?
Mr. Chair and Representative Abler, it looks like, so the 28,000 are auto-enrolled initially, and by fiscal year 11, on average, we've got 15,000 individuals of the 28.
So are we to assume then that the other 13,000 will not have any health care?
I think that's probably a fair assumption.
And where, but the question is, in my hospitals, do you expect them to not be around? Do you expect their health care to be over with? Do you expect them then to have just charity care?
Mr. Chair, I know that they will not be enrolled in general assistance medical care.
But our society doesn't step over dead bodies and let them lay there. They're still going to have...
My guess is they will still be entering the hospital like they would normally.
And so that's a potential cost then to either charity care, which is, and there's no free lunch here. It's just, you know, if my hospital loses money, they got to raise everybody's rate in order, and then that my insurance goes up. I mean, there's just no free lunch. So I guess my long-term question then is the administration working on some kind of a way to be able to address that particular problem? We got a short-term problem. You got a short-term solution for a little bit in a few 6 months. But there's a long-term problem here that has to be addressed. And it has an effect on the state budget and has an effect on everyone's budget. So are you trying to come up with a way to address that?
Mr. Chairman, I'll check with Commissioner Ludeman when I'm done with the hearing today.
Okay, well, I think that's the question that Representative Thiessen and Representative Hutley need to have before them as well.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Abel, I cut you off.
I appreciate the dialogue. And I'm not going to ask my other question about how much this accelerated. Maybe I should ask that in a minute. But there's been some activity from the industry. You're correct that there's some outstate issues, but some of the two leaders in the solutions have been regions in Hennepin County. And they're looking at some ways to do kind of some of the service people, at least with maybe half the price tag, which I think is really innovative of them. And I like especially the Hennepin County model that they're bringing up, which is way beyond the scope of this thing. But this is really the job of the legislature to figure this out. I think that the administration's point of view, and they haven't even talked to me much, but as I surmise this, the shift to Minnesota Care, expecting that a little more than half will stay in, and they're going to debit the general fund to pay for that, is, I believe, the plan that's before us. And it's a difficult time, and I think it's a better than nothing plan. No one, I think, is fond of it. I don't think even Commissioner Ludeman is very fond of that, but it's, at least there's some stopgap thing. We'll be in session by then, and if there's some good dialogue, we can come up with a plan.
Well, Representative Abler, I know it's a legislative prerogative to try to do this, but in order for us to do it, we have to have some statistics and some proposals from the staff at the Department of Human Services as well. So look forward to that dialogue and that cooperation. Representative Benson?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted a point of information before I do that to respond. It's my memory that the state legislature did, in fact, deal with Minnesota Care. It was the governor's actions that threw this into cocked hat, if I remember right. But anyway, just a point of information, I received from Hennepin County my property tax statement, and I'm willing to stand corrected, but if I remember right, in large orange print, it said that Hennepin County was raising my property taxes approximately 2% to pay for Minnesota or HCMC. So,
compensated care.
Yes, for the uncompensated care. So, Again, the taxpayers, property taxpayers of the state of Minnesota, are being asked to carry a burden which had been dealt with by the legislature. I just want that on the record.
Okay. Representative Pepin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a general comment on Minnesota Care, just a reminder to perhaps Representative Thiessen and Representative Carlson. And the legislator I'm talking about isn't here to defend himself, but I do want to point out that Representative Gottwald has been working for a very long time on the Healthy Minnesota Act, which is completely revamping Minnesota Care. I believe that it received an informational hearing in the waning days of session, and it got ruled out of order when it was brought up on the House floor, but that proposal is something that we definitely should look into, and Representative Gottwald and others in the industry thinks that will save the state millions, and perhaps we'll also deal with the issue that Representative Carlson talked about with the $10,000 cap, I believe, his proposal. I don't think there was a cap. I was checking with Representative Abelin, and I don't think there was a cap on what his proposal would have covered, and it would have been better health care for both the insuree and save money to the state. So I would strongly encourage you, Representative Thiessen, to give that bill. I don't have the House file number in front of me, but I would strongly encourage you to give that a real hearing with members of the industry and Commissioner Hansen. I would encourage you to talk to some more to Representative Gottwald on that, because I think it has real potential.
Representative Thiessen?
Well, first of all, thank you, Mr. Chair. We actually held a hearing and passed it out of my committee, so I don't know. We actually took a vote and passed it. So we actually did have a real hearing on it. And my understanding is it actually saves no money if you look at the FIFO note, and there's been a little bit of mythology around that. But I would suggest you talk to George Hoffman, and I know Representative Gottwald has been doing that. But we have taken that proposal very seriously, and actually had another hearing in Representative Huntley's committee, 2 days of hearings, in fact, on that proposal, and which were informational in nature. But I don't want to get too far off track. The question I had, just following up on Representative Abler's question, and maybe the woman who was here needs to come down again. I actually think, as I understand the proposal, it's not just going to be people transitioning on as of March 1st, but people are going to be continually put on to transitional Minnesota Care. As they apply for GMC, they'll be automatically enrolled in transitional Minnesota Care. So there will be more people coming on. Of course, there's no retroactive coverage. So someone that shows up at the hospital in the emergency room, that's all on compensated care, because under Minnesota Care, you know, it's only forward going instead of GMC, which looks back and will actually, if you show up, it'll cover from the day of your application instead of the day you're enrolled. So all the hospital stuff that we're talking about doesn't get fixed under transitional Minnesota Care. But I think that actually raises the point that the numbers, that 50% is not right. It's actually closer to 25% or less, and that's what George Hoffman told us yesterday, that will actually fall, that will continue after the 6 months. So there's going to be all kinds of churning going on, which wastes all kinds of our money in this program. And so I think we just need to have all those facts on the table as we understand how this program is actually
Representative Goffel, then we're going to go on to
this. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted, if the GMAC discussion is over, I'd like to actually go back to the forecast.
Okay. Did you have a comment, Commissioner?
Before Representative Thiessen leaves.
Sorry. You know, we did the auto enrollment, Mr. Chairman, and a lot of the major money decisions that we knew that are kind of looming, we waited till after the forecast. And I know we're going to be talking about this. I don't know if Cal's got something cooking, but I will say I'm glad I'm a management and budget commissioner.
But okay, we're going to talk about. Can we continue on then? We've kind of spent a lot of time on an extremely important issue, that because in the forecast, it is something that needs to be addressed.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Taking up the presentation where we left it off, mentioned that the line item veto, the general assistance medical care, was an issue, and moving on to federal stimulus funding, that is also included in the funding levels and spending levels that you see in this forecast. If you recall back to last session, we all agreed on the treatment of the state stabilization funds as well as federal matching funds. These essentially are used to offset normal general fund spending. So when you're looking at our spending numbers in 2010 and 11, they're not reflecting the revenues or the spending that's associated with that stimulus money that's actually outside in the federal funds. in 12 and 13, those dollars come back into play in the general fund number.
So the 12 and 13 spending then would increase because of the lack of the federal funds.
Exactly, Mr. Chair. Oh,
there's no change in law in that.
It's not a change in law. It is just a change in the funding source because the federal dollars are one time. Okay. And that gets us to the 12 and 13 planning outlook. We've touched upon this a little bit, but basically the deficit that we're projecting is growing from about $4.4 billion to about $5.4 billion. That's not including the impact of inflation, which is not included in the forecast by statute. It's not including some of the payment deferrals, but it is including another one. You see the assumptions that are included in that number below. Certainly there's been a lot of discussion around what the long-term obligations and the long-term state of the deficit budget. We tried to lay that information out for you as we all enter into more decision-making this spring.
Okay.
Last thing is...
Just one second. We're going to... Let's see if we can pay attention. I think cash flow will be.
Mr. Chair, you just briefly asked about the cash flow of the state. I'll touch on that real briefly if you want.
Well, I do have some questions on it a little bit. So when you're finished with your... with your presentation, are you done with that?
I am, and Mr. will close it up.
Okay.
So this is just the Mr. Chairman, the final aggregate number in the forecast. That's all we have.
Representative Goswell has something on the forecast itself. Representative Goswell.
Garoppolo?
I'm sorry.
It was more of a macro question, Mr. Chairman, for Dr. Stinson. And I wanted your opinion on something, Dr. Stinson, that at a high level, the U.S. economy is predominantly about 70% consumer spending. Over the last 10 years, the growth in that spending has been financed primarily not by wage income or wage growth, but rather by borrowing and by some unsustainable bubbles and irrational exuberance of the stock market, of home values. In addition to that, we've seen that the value of the dollar right now is in a position of strategic weakness, and it appears that the economy is set to transition from one that is of a consumer spending economy financed by borrowing and bubbles to an investment-based economy financed by savings, which long-term would be good, but would seem to be, in its transition, very difficult. And I am of the opinion that regardless of the policy actions we take at a state or federal level, regardless of who wins elections, that we're going to have a sustained period of time here with difficult choices where the alignment between resources and needs will continue to be disconnected. And I'm just wondering if, and again, I'm looking at a 3 to 5 year time horizon. I am of the view that regardless of the policy actions we take, that's the difficult choices we have to make. And I'm just wondering, giving you carte blanche to tell me why I'm wrong, and if you could just offer some thoughts again at a high level view outside of Minnesota policy.
Dr. Stinson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Groff, well, as you know, I'm the optimist, but I'm less optimistic than you are about the time span that we're going to struggle. This recession was a serious problem for the global economy, not just for the Minnesota economy or the U.S. economy. And the actions that the federal government had to take, which, you know, I support and were very necessary, are going to be very difficult to unwind in a smooth and rational fashion. And so there are two risks. The one risk is that there's a policy mistake in the unwinding of some of this, and we don't do enough stimulus, or we do too much, and then we have to counter that. It's not like we're walking on the edge of a cliff, and as long as we lean away from the abyss, we're going to be okay. We're really walking on a very narrow trail that has a cliff on both sides, and if we lean too far on one side or on the other side, we're going to be in trouble. I have confidence that the people that are in charge, you know, Larry Summers is the smartest guy that I've ever met, and you know, somebody like Larry Summers is going to do his best. Ben Bernanke is a very smart guy and is very well studied on monetary policy and depressions and things like that. And so I have confidence that they're going to do the best that they can, but and the best that can be done, but the limits of our knowledge are such that they can still make mistakes. So that's the first concern that I have, is that, you know, there could be a mistake and a year from now we could be in more trouble. The second concern that I have, though, is that even though they could make a mistake, the growth is not going to be as fast. And this is your point, I think. The growth is not going to be as fast because the Fed in particular is going to be concerned about keeping inflation under control, and so they are going to have higher interest rates than we would have expected under normal circumstances. And I think it's going to take longer than your 3 to 5 years for those interest rates to get back to more normal levels and for us to get back into a more normal equilibrium position. And so because of that, I think we're going to grow more slowly than we did in the 80s or 90s or the early 2000s because of the higher interest rates. Now, there's going to be more investment because people are going to be saving more, but the higher interest rates are still going to choke off some of the additional investment that would be needed, and so productivity is probably not going to be as high as it is. So I think we're, and most economists would give you the same analysis, I think, whereas the expected real growth rate was maybe 3% on average over the last decade or 20 years, the expected growth rate going on out is more like 2.5% or 2.75%. It's going to knock some of the growth off of that. And then you complicate that with the problems of aging that the state demographer and I have talked about a lot. It's going to be a very difficult time for an extended period of time. It's not going to be something that we solve in 3 to 5 years.
Commissioner, just one thing, and I'll get to represent Junkie. One of the difficulties we have in the next few months is to try to come up with a mutual understanding of how we solve the budget, and both on a short-term basis, we have to do that. And then hopefully we can start addressing it on a long-term basis as well. And the earlier we do that on a short-term basis helps us on the long-term basis as well to address that that budget. I don't want to kick the can down the road anymore, if we, at least not as far as we've been kicking it in the past and putting it into the next biennium, if at all possible. In order for us to do that, Representative Krause and I know and others are going to be holding hearings in December, January, on how we make the cuts that are necessary to be made so that they have the least amount of impact on the job market. And then what other things we can do to improve our job situation. As you have said right from the beginning, and Dr. Spence said this right from the beginning, this is an income tax problem for collection, and our biggest bottom of the pyramid is the jobs. And we need to have proposals from the administration on how to address both of those issues, both what kind of plans you might have to be able to create some jobs, and then also what kind of plans you have to be able to make the cuts that the legislature can consider and respond to. Our goal is to work very cooperatively with the administration. But in order for us to do that, we don't have all the staff, the fiscal staff, to do the analysis that needs to be done in Health and Human Services or any of the other agencies. So our expectation is, our hope is, that the administration, the governor's office, will give us some budget balancing proposals very early. I mean, very, very early. So I maybe Representative Carlson would like to comment on that as well.
Well, exactly. In fact, the governor has commented that time is important, and when I've dealt with these kinds of issues before, probably the best example that I've used in the past is the early 80s, it became very clear that we want to have time on our side. And so we will be sending a letter, Chair and I and others, to the governor and copying you, Mr. Hansen, probably today or tomorrow, requesting basically, as Chair Solberg has pointed out, that we get your recommendations as soon as possible. We'd like to have those recommendations actually prior to the legislative session, because as Representative Solberg or Chair Solberg pointed out, we're going to begin having or continuing the hearings. We do have the special subcommittee that has a meeting on the 14th. Much of that discussion, as you know, will be on follow-up on this meeting, the forecast. But we are interested in getting your recommendations so we can begin to react to those and be prepared to act as soon as possible during the legislative session.
To that point, Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think what you're asking of the governor's staff is very fair, all right? And I appreciate your comments here as the first comments I've heard all day where it's an outreach to the governor's office. I was a little disappointed earlier during this meeting when it seemed to be the attack job on the governor's office rather than the outreach that we know we're going to need to have. If this is truly going to be a partnership in solving this problem, it is fair to ask the governor's office for his recommendations, but I also think it is quite fair for the legislature to come to the table with suggestions as well. Let's not sit back, let's not cross our hands in front of ourselves and say, well, governor's office didn't want to play ball again if we're not willing to do exactly the same thing we're asking them. This is a three-legged stool.
I think the process has been in place already. There's two questions that are extremely important, and the legislature and the governor have to be involved. And that's the question of short and long-term balancing the budget, but also in the long-term, one of the biggest things that this forecast tells us is the lack of jobs. And we have to try to address that. That in itself has solved 10 problems if someone's working as opposed to not working. And we will be holding hearings and going forward with that as well. But they have also, the administration has much of the information on it. And we do not have a legislative budget office. We rely on them for those, and we need that dialogue and open to that, I'm sure. One of the other things I want to cover, and I'll get to Representative Junkie as well, and that is Representative Rukavina brought up the cash flow business, and that is extremely important because I know the administrations in the past have had flexibility in being able to borrow short-term and long-term, short-term to be able to make the cash obligations and the cash flow. Representative Hansen, or Commissioner Hansen, would you like to at least give us your thoughts on this, and I know it's a looming problem that we're going to have to also address.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. But before we, Jim and I, get to the chart, we owe you a bonding bill, and we do owe you a supplemental budget. And I think we've done that every even year. We come forward with a supplemental budget, and we realize we're all going to work on it together.
Let me make an emphasis on that. I would like to not wait until after the February forecast to get those recommendations. Even if they're not complete, give us some information.
Mr. Chairman, I think that's a little late.
Okay. Commissioner?
And I'll have Jim talk about the chart in a minute, but we have broad, Mr. Chairman, statutory authority to, even in times of surplus, we move funds around our statutory general fund. We have our general fund that we talk about in terms of the forecast, but we have our statutory general fund, which includes Minsky and everything else. And we move cash around to even out those times where we have more payments and we receive less. And I'll have Jim just talk about this chart for a minute before I go on.
Sure. Mr. Chair, what you're looking at here is a chart based upon
end of session after unallotment, projections of the cash balances on a daily basis. So it's just all the members understand. What we do at the MMB is once we've got a forecast, once we have an enacted budget, we then take a look at that and push it down literally to the daily level. When do we anticipate aids and credit payments going up? When do we anticipate HMO payments going up from DHS? Throughout the course of the year, match that up with the revenue. Those dates are relatively set, and so these all match up then over the course of the year. As you quite well know, they don't all happen perfectly in unison. So we tend to spend some of our money, a disproportionate amount of our money in the first half of the year, receive disproportionate money, receive more of it in the second half of the year. So that's what you get is sort of a historical kind of pattern of the state's cash balances changing over the course of the year. As the commissioner mentioned, the statutory general fund isn't just the general fund. It includes the Health Care Access Fund, includes the Special Revenue Fund, MNSCU, a number of other non-constitutionally dedicated funds, non-pension funds. With that authority to manage cash, what you see is that over the course of the year, we have some payments that go out early in the year, and then way late in the year, around June, you start to see the impact of the June accelerated sales tax. You see the impact of statewide property tax coming in, taking us from a low balance of around $500 million up to a ending balance of about $2 billion. Between now and then, there's some low points. And this is before we talked about what our revenues were coming in on a monthly basis this year. This is before the forecast that we're discussing here today. You see that there's a couple of low points, one in late November and December, early December. We just experienced that. Yesterday, in between briefings, we were at about $44 million in the general fund, not the statutory general fund, but in the general fund itself. By the end of the day, we had more than $300 million.
Someone won the lottery.
actually statewide property tax.
Okay, yeah.
And so just to give you a sense of how volatile this figure is, that in a single day, you know, we can go from, gosh, I hope nobody cuts a very large check today, to, okay, we're probably okay again. That is the kind of volatility on a daily basis that you see, and that goes over the course of the year. As our balances get lower, obviously we are monitoring it extraordinarily closely, trying to figure out how to make sure that we have no surprises. That's part of the context of our discussion on cash flow with the LCCFP, and we basically have just gone through one of those low points. We have an additional low point coming up in April and May, March, April, and May, again, where a lot of our refunds are going out, where our income taxes are not coming in yet, where we still have a lot of our payments that have already gone out, the cash balance then rebounds later in June. The overall cash balance, I should say, has been drifting downward over the last several years. This isn't a unique, totally new situation. It is continually underperforming on our revenue side. It's continually using some of our one-time resources, balances, and other funds. Don't help. When we use that to balance our general fund, that doesn't help this picture. When we eliminate our budget reserve, that doesn't help this picture. It slowly draws down our cash balance, and that's what we're trying to manage through right now.
Okay, Commissioner Hanson.
Mr. Chairman, members, as Jim said, what our budget operations people at MMB are going to do now is put our cash flow projections for the next year. Just because we had a $1.2 billion deficit yesterday doesn't necessarily mean we will have to borrow in March and April. It depends on what much of the revenue loss, if you dig into the forecast, actually comes in the second year of the biennium. But we still are going to put that in the cash flow projection going forward. I still believe, for planning purposes, that setting up a short-term borrowing mechanism allows us to have it planned just in case. And it would be the kind of mechanism where we would notify you if we ever had to use it, if we did approach that zero on the chart that we're talking about. So I guess I would still like to move forward, as I discussed at Representative Carlson's hearing a couple weeks ago, and try and get something set up, and hope to work with you in the weeks to come, and hopefully have it set up before session.
Okay. Just a couple of announcements. make sure your expenses are signed and turned in to staff. And then additionally, I'm going to be appointing a subcommittee that deals with fiscal notes as well. Representative Junkie.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just want to start setting the table. I listened to my friends, Representative Groslow and Abler, and I was talking to Representative Hilty earlier on the same subject, and Bunn and others on this side. You know, I think people who are watching here or listening, and our message going forward from today, this is something different in the state. This isn't like it's been the last 14 years I've been here. And we're hearing our folks up there say it. I mean, if you add inflation, the recognition shift, GEMC, and our projected deficit, we are at $8 billion deficit starting in the next fiscal cycle on a $32 billion budget. That's 25%. And, you know, members, I think we're starting to understand. And again, this is no one's fault. This isn't the fault of the previous majority. This isn't the fault of the current majority. It isn't the fault of this governor or the previous governor. They all had pieces to play along the way, and it's fun to point fingers. But listen to what was said today and try and understand where we're going. Our economist stated, this is 3 to 5 years, maybe more, we're not growing out of this. Jobs are important, Representative Solberg. We're going to put a heck of a jobs bill forward. We won't grow out of it. Producing jobs will not get us out of this. Cutting taxes will not get us out. I heard that yesterday at a press conference. You know, okay, let's cut the corporate income tax, put it to zero. That doesn't fix our problem. Raising revenues. We put a $1 billion revenue bill on the governor's desk. He vetoed it. That won't fix our problem. You know, spending cuts. We cannot cut, take education off the table. Then we cut everything else 50%. And that just gets us back to even. We can't cut our way there. Members and people have to start thinking about, we have a major demographic shift in this state, an aging population, and we have to start as a group, bipartisanly and in the governor's office, frankly, we're not at this point seeing the leadership that we need from anyone. I'll take the blame as well as everyone else, but when you see this, it should make everyone gasp. Sit back a little bit and start thinking about looking forward together on what this state will look like and how we're going to put together budgets in the next few years. And that's not allotting. Those are one-time fixes or taking tobacco money. And it's not ignoring inflation like we did. So we have more money to spend in this budget. You know, we should have had another $1.2 billion set aside because of inflation, but we ignored it too on our leadership side. When you guys were in charge, we cut taxes and we increased spending on a bubble back in the early 2000s. You shouldn't have done that. There were a lot of mistakes made because we're not recognizing, and we're not the only ones. This amplifies that it's all over the country. But again, we have to quit throwing balls back and forth and doing these short-term, one-time things. We have to actually dig into our systems and really start understanding how we're going to rebuild this state economy. And it's not going to be short time. You know, I hear people, well, let's just get out of here and we'll go to the elections and then we'll come back. You know, the next governor, I don't care who it is, facing an $8 billion deficit, how irresponsible is that for the current governor to leave that or for any of us? And so I think, you know, you folks were right. You're starting to get on the right track, and so are people, a lot of people on this side of the aisle, but I don't think the rest of the population has quite understood what's going on to us, and that it's a demographic, it's a geographic, it's a larger problem than this one-time thing. And again, listening to Dr. Stinson, I appreciate that. We are not growing out of this, and it's a many-year thing if we go down the same path we're going down. And I fear we're doing that right now. So again, myself, and I hope others, will start messaging that out there, and we'll start telling people to come together and figure this thing out, because there's no easy fix on this. And, you know, I just want to start setting the table, Mr. Chair and others, because the last 2 days it's been an interesting observation to watch different press conferences and what people are saying, but most people aren't addressing it, and they're just throwing it down the road again.
Thank you. Other things before us, just want to make a statement on this. We have spent now exactly 2 hours in session. We started 10 minutes late. I want to stop by saying that we've had some conversations, and I've had with the commissioner on the difficulties that is inherent in sometimes in getting the fiscal notes in a timely fashion. And there's nobody at fault. It's just been a difficulty. I want to try to improve that system, work with the agencies to be able to see what we can do to improve the system so information flows better. By the way, before I go, thank you for doing some of the transfers that I introduced a bill for last year and wasn't able to accomplish. Legislation by the commissioner, I guess. That's okay. Appreciate that. But I'd like to appoint a subcommittee to deal with just how we can address the issues of allowing fiscal notes, how to improve that system. So I'm going to ask Representative Kahn to chair that, include Representative Aber, Representative Hoppe, Representative Huntley, Representative Rood, Scalzi, and then Representative Holberg and myself will be ex-official members on that. And we'll see if we can, I know we'll take some resources from MMB to be able to address that, but let's see if we can improve. Okay, thank you. Any other things?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, just wrapping things up, I just wanted to, I've gotten like 5 text messages about this. My attire today does not mean that I'm authoring the Viking Stadium. I just want to make that very clear. So, thank you very much.
I assumed that right away, and you're going to the rally? Well, I want to ask you a question. Would you be willing to pay some additional tax on that thing that you did not have to wear today to be able to fund the Vikings so you can continue to have a Viking? All right. With that, the meeting is adjourned.